My name is Karen Hebert, and I am here today with Kim Williams and William Johnson and
Marianne
Johnson at their home in Dillingham, Alaska. And I'm going to have them each introduce themselves, giving me their full name, the year and place they were born. And then we can go around and hear a little bit about where they spent their early years before learning more about their experiences here in Bristol Bay.
My name is William Johnson. I was born in Nagushik, Alaska, which is a summer fishing camp. My father was a Swede from Sweden, and my mother was from Nelson Island, so she's a Yupik Eskimo, so I'm a Swede Eskimo. And I grew up here in Dillingham. The year that I was born in Nagushik, my family moved up to Dillingham here, and we had a home over here, which is gone now. And, well, today's December 10th, too. I don't think she mentioned that.
I should have.
And in my formative years, I grew up in a family which was commercial fishing. My father set netted early, but he also fished in the boat, and my mother was a set netter. So I grew up set netting every summer, and we also put up fish in a fish during the season, too. We smoked fish and we salted fish. And my dad, he had many gardens, and we grew potatoes and rutabagas and turnips and whatever, mostly all vegetables. And because he was, being a Swede, they grew their own foods in Sweden. In the middle 40s, I started school here in Dillingham. My father had held me back. So when I started school, I think I was 7 years old. And in the wintertime, we went to school in a dog team, and everybody had dog teams. So I remember going to school in the wintertime, and at 30 below, it was a miserable trip. About a two-mile trip to the school, and it was miserable cold. And the roads we had weren't maintained. It was a gravel road, never spring. When the snow melted, then we had transportation on the road. And thinking back, I think I packed water, I cut wood, just like my dad did. He taught us how. He took us out into the woods, and we cut wood. And so we knew how to keep the family warm. And we had a wood stove in the house. And in those years, houses weren't very big, because if you had a big house, it took a lot of wood to keep warm. So later on, I was the first one to graduate from high school in our family. And everybody else quit to go to work, make money, and support the family. But in those days, salmon was an important resource, both for monetary purposes, and also it was the gasoline for our transportation. It fed the dogs. And my wife and I, we both grew up cooking for dogs. My dad's dog team, and she cooked for her dad's dog team, and they split fish, caught fish, split fish, and hung them up on a rack, and then they them in bundles and store them in the dogfish shack. That's where he kept their dog food. And I graduated from a territorial high school, 1958. The next year, in 59, Alaska became a state. In the mid-60s, we started organizing. Prior to that, in the late 50s, I got involved with a fishing organization called the Western Alaska Cooperative Marketing Association, in where I also met people that were leaders in our community in the fishing, especially in the fishing industry. I met all the cannery superintendents, because I got elected to the board of WACMA, And I knew Winbrindle, all the pioneers in the fishing industry. And I also met most of the people who were involved in that, were the leaders in our community, namely Harvey Samuelson, Herman Schroeder, and Jim Brandon. Jim was an Eskimo from Nome, and he was the first one that I ever heard say, if you want something, you gotta organize. And that's how I became involved in organization through WACMA, and then later on we started with the Johnson's administration of the Office of Economic Opportunity. We got involved with ROLCAP, the development corporations in Bristol Bay. We had a Bristol Bay Area Development Corporation, and I got involved in that, in the administration, originally and eventually becoming the director. And that's through that organization we got involved in the Native Alaska settlement, Alaska Native Settlement organizations. And being involved in that, eventually I became an administrator, and we helped organize, we implemented the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act after it was passed. And I remember going to the meeting of AFN in Anchorage where Richard Nixon addressed the group, and at that time he signed the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. After that, we had to implement the act. We had to organize the village corporations and also the regional corporation. I was one of the incorporators of the Bristol Bay Native Association Corporation. And I was all involved in that for 20-some years. But in the meantime, I also commercial fished every summer. In order to be a good fisherman, you have to have a good winter job. Mm-hmm. And we enjoy that. I enjoy that type of lifestyle where we have to work, because work is what keeps everything going.
Absolutely. And let's return to some of the work that you did in all of those different organizations. Maybe we can finish going around the room and have everyone here just give a quick little state your name and where you were born and where you spent your early years, and then we can come back to all talking together about some of all of your family's involvement in these issues over the years.
I don't want to do this.
Just say your name and...
I'm Mary Ann Johnson, married to William P. Johnson.
Born
in Conaklack.
Raised
in Dillingham.
What's your maiden name?
Olona. My maiden name is Olona. There was 8 of us kids.
And your father came from... He grew up in an orphanage, and he originally came from Port Hyden area.
Oh, wow.
So he came up here in around 1920, and he grew up and lived in an orphanage. I guess he got here when he was somewhere around 5 years old. And he grew up in an orphanage, and that's why Bristol Bay is comprised of many Native people from throughout the Bristol Bay region, mainly because they came to the orphanage and then they stayed around here and they grew up around in this area. So when you go and talk to some of these old people nowadays, you can know, they will tell you, that they were from Iggy, Port Hyden, Togiak, because they were all brought here by the government, and they grew up in the orphanage, and then they stayed around here.
And you all had children. How many children?
5.
Mm-hmm.
Including one who's right here.
My name is Kimberly Williams, and I am the oldest daughter of William and Marianne Johnson, who's sitting here. I was born at Conaknack, just like my mom, And I have three brothers. I had one sister who passed away when she was in high school. And I grew up listening to all of the politics and the organizations that my dad did in his work, but also my mom through her activity through the village council. She served on, she was elected to the village council, so the tribal council, and then she served on the housing authority board, and she served on the hospital board, and so I grew up having board members coming into our house and listening to them. But I remember, and especially realized from all of that activity, that there was some duties put on children of organized families and leadership, that you had to go to school and you had to go and get an education and come back. And I have the first one in my family that has a bachelor's degree and the first one in my family that has a master's degree. But then my children, my daughter, has a doctorate. So from a high school diploma from my father, and his mom probably had a sixth grade education, or at least my mom's grandma had a sixth grade education. Just in the span of three generations, we now have doctorates in our family. So that's a big achievement, and I think of that in itself is what has happened in our region and how education has played a really important role. And not only organizing, but realizing that our future is really dependent on education.
So these are great perspectives. And maybe I can ask you all to speak a little bit more about the different things continue to talk about your involvements and how that influenced your perspectives on what were the most important resource issues that people were concerned about in Bristol Bay, whether in the days of WACMA or in more recent years in the work that you've all been involved in doing. Whether you want to also speak to how you actually, the activities that you did involving natural resources or your political involvements or both would be great.
Well, one of the major things that we are concerned about as commercial fishermen is the price that we receive from fishermen, and that's why I got involved in WACMA in the first place. And we know that unless we organize, and the fishermen are independent and disorganized nowadays, we don't have the organizations that were set up to market our resources and to negotiate with the buyers of our salmon to receive the best possible price for our fish. Nowadays, we're disorganized, and the price of fish has plummeted, and that's related mainly to the disorganization of the fishermen. And if the fishermen want to get together and see improvement in the price of their products, they will have to organize and start an organization in which they can go to each of the companies and negotiate fish prices. Unless that happens, we're going to continue to see the price of fish drop and our return diminish.
And so tell me how people in Bristol Bay have been organized over time. You said you were really involved in the creation, it sounds like, of both the BBNA and the BBNC. And so what were the main goals of those folks, you and others who were involved in building those organizations at the time? What did you most want to address in doing that?
Well, you got to look at what was driving the... what was our feelings back when, I graduated from a territorial high school and the following year became a state. And after statehood, the state started selecting land. And they were selecting land that we used. So one of the first groups that confronted this was the Bristol Bay Area Development Corporation, which is organized under ROLCAP, which is still in existence today in Anchorage. Okay. And they put on a native allotment drive that was get the natives to apply for land that they use for berry picking, hunting, and whatever, trapping, and file for native allotments. And that's one of my first goals, one of my first tasks.
And what year was that about?
In 1967, 68, in that area. Mm-hmm. And, no, yeah, it was in that time frame. And so there was only three of us in the staff, so we just broke up the region into what areas that we would go and visit and help people file for native allotments. And I took the Yupik-speaking area because I was able to understand and speak the Yupik language to some extent. Mm-hmm. And then we had Linda Backford, who took care of the upriver, and the Elkin people drove down here, so she took care of the upriver, and Tulangus, and he took care of the west, the peninsula, and Iliam, the lake region. And I guess we were pretty good at what we did, because Bristol Bay ended up with the most native allotments filed in the state of the regions. So we knew how. We learned how to do things. And then following that, after a native allotment, then the whole state got involved in getting the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act into being. Had to fight the politicians and public opinion. And so here we are today. From being involved in WACMA, we got into the Native Claims, and from the Native Claims, we got all these other organizations, Bristol Bay Health Corporation, all the other BBs, and then we also supported the University of Alaska to get the Bristol Bay campus here. That was one of the things that we supported. Because we know that education is the foundation of everything.
And so this is a question for you and everyone else. But looking back, especially given how many different important initiatives you've been involved with, a lot of the issues that you mentioned about fish prices and control of native lands, what do you see as having changed the most, and what do you see as staying the same from the past to the present?
Well, the biggest change I've seen is the negative influence of the... I mean, the canneries, you got to say, are organized, because they have substantially reduced the cost of the product that they have. I mean, diminished the price of the product that they buy from the fishermen. Last year it was down to 50 cents a pound. And that is not very good. So the biggest problem that we Bristol Bay faces right now is the fish prices. And unless they get organized, they're going to continue to see a diminution in prices, especially if the state of Alaska gets a minimum wage of $15 an hour. They would have to pay the cannery workers $15 an hour, which I think the current price is somewhere around $7, $8. So you're going to see a doubling in their wage, and in order for the canneries to make money, they're going to have to cut where they can, and where they can cut is the disorganized price that they pay to the fishermen.
And what did you do when you were involved in WACMA in the past? What did you do to be effective in the organizing? How did WACMA work?
We negotiated with the fishermen, and the fishermen were... I mean, there wasn't that many fishermen back in those days. Generally, there was about 1,300 active participants in the drift fishery. Now, with the passage of the limited entry law, everyone who participated in the past had an opportunity to file for and obtain a limited entry permit. And originally, after the passage and people got their permits, some guys that were getting old, they sold their permits for next to nothing. Mm. And that's how we've seen a migration of permits going to mainly people on the outside, and there's nothing that's going to change it because they have the financial backing and the know-how on how to get loans to get involved in the fishery, and they're buying permits for their kids. Mm-hmm. And we're going to see a Alaskan residents becoming a, they are already a minority in a limited entry fishery. So I don't see anything right now that will work, like get the fishermen organized until the fishermen get sick of the low price that they're getting for mm-hmm. their fish.
Mm-hmm. What about the other issue you mentioned? It sounds like you were really successful in Bristol Bay and getting a lot of native allotments, but in terms of control over lands in this area, and lands that, you know, native people, you all included, have harvested on for many years, whether it's control by the state or other kinds of outside developers, how has that changed over time? Or where do you see that sort of heading?
Well, right now, after we, you know, looking at the economic situation in Bristol Bay, you know, there have been a lot of hard times going around, and we've seen a lot of those native allotment change hands. They, you know, people have sold them, and that's a negative aspect of what we thought would happen. We thought that you know, once you own land, you, if you take care of it properly, you can get a good return on it. But that hasn't happened, except for a few people.
And even beyond allotments, you know, we've heard in recent years about lots of different proposals to potentially, you know, develop mining in Bristol Bay and other sorts of things. How do you see that fitting into the challenges that that were there when you were involved in these issues in the 50s, 60s, 70s?
Well, one of the main reasons that we're concerned about is the water quality. And if there's any danger to our resource, it would be contamination of our water resource. And mining is has a great potential for reducing the quality of our water. And we know that our waters in Bristol Bay support the greatest red salmon fishery in the world. And the only thing that can change it is mining and contamination of our water resources.
So, Dad, when you were a chairman of BB&A, when did you guys first hear about large-scale mining?
We always were in favor of mining. Even just when we first organized Bristol Bay, we had we hired consultants who compiled information on mineral resources in that region, in our region, because we wanted to become involved in resource extraction also. But after over time, our view of mining has changed drastically, because we know that our salmon resources is dependent upon good water.
So, Dad, why didn't, when you worked at BB&C and you were the director of lands at BB&C, Pebble is on state land. Why didn't BB&C select that site? Because you knew back then there was potential for mineral development. So why didn't BB&C select the Pebble prospect?
Well, we really didn't know that there was a prospect there. We knew that there was one in over by Kakanak, and we had that explored by Cominco. We had an agreement with Cominco, and the exploration of the Pebble Prospect occurred afterwards, and so we were unaware of the Pebble Prospect. We didn't know about it. And it wasn't even on the horizon then, when we had to complete our land selection. We had a deadline for our land selections, and by the time that was, the Pebble Prospect surfaced after we did our land selections.
I always understood the record that there was always the mineral potential at the Pebble Prospect, and that even back in the late 50s or the 60s, that Pebble was kind of, there was a mineral potential there, although they didn't know what the prospect was, just like Humboldt, which is by Stuyahok and Kliganek, Shotgun Hills. I mean, these are all mineral potentials that we've had in the region that people knew about or had an idea about back in the late 50s, early 60s. And I guess from my perspective in working on these issues, one of the reasons why I understood BBNC didn't select Pebble was because of the fishery and because of salmon and spawning.
No, we just didn't know about it.
You didn't know about it?
Yeah, we didn't know about the potential, nor we didn't even know it existed as a possible mineral prospect.
And I'm curious to hear more about how it came to be that a lot of organizations in this region were really excited about the prospect, or at least open to the prospect of something like mining, and then came to see things a bit differently in recent years. And maybe you can talk more about how that changed over time, too.
Well, it was a change in our attitude. You know, originally we thought that the extraction of resources would be a good business to get into to keep the organization productive. But then over time we've learned that mining has great potential for doing away with our resources, or heavily impacting our resource, which is the salmon.
And when did that happen, and how did you think that, you know, what made everyone come to that new realization?
It's a recent thing, especially after Pebble came out and they started proposing their big hole in the ground.
But I think, you know, like Tech Kaminko, that first held the claims to the Pebble Prospect, that was in late 89. And back in the 80s when Tech Kaminko came out, they only, you know, they had like two or three drill holes, and came out and started talking to the villagers. They went to BBNA, and they basically had the conversation with BBNA. And you got to remember, back in the 80s, BBNA was like, and BBNC were like the spokesman for the native community in Bristol Bay. And they carried a large club back then. So if you went to an organization like BBNA and made a presentation and they said no, then I think that fell into Tech Kaminko's decision-making, not only because it wasn't economical with the three holes that they dug, but BBNA passed a resolution that said, no, you know, we are opposed to the development of this project. So they, back in the late 80s, they knew somewhat about mining and the destruction that mining caused. But the perception or the groundswell of opposition to large-scale mining in Bristol Bay really happened when Northern Dynasty bought the claim and started pitting the region against each other. So they hired a bunch of people up in Iliamna and New Halen and put them to work and got them all fired up about economics and jobs. And then this side of the region, the Nishiak, and the west side of the region, we weren't part of a borough, so there was all these other dynamics happening when Northern Dynasty purchased that claim that really caused a division in our region. Dad's right. I mean, large-scale mining and the destruction to water quality is the biggest player, and modern mining techniques can't stop dams that are breaking that happened down in Brazil, where their tailings impoundment facility broke and killed people and destroyed communities, and the Mount Polly disaster in Canada is just another example of what can happen to a fishery. And so it's a no-brainer for the fishermen of this region and the outside fishermen of the area to say, yeah, our salmon's going to be impacted by any large-scale mining. And so I think you've seen subsistence, commercial, and sports fishermen all united, which had never happened before, to get that united front opposed to one project like never before. I mean, I remember Board of Fish fights, and I'm not an active commercial fisherman, but all of the politics that happened in the Board of Fish meetings of in terms of allocation and who can kill fish and who can get the most fish, there were some pretty heavy battles, and these groups are now united on this large-scale project.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear everyone talk about more. Well, Marianne and William, if you can remember how groups used to interact on these issues and if you've seen that change at all, whether internally within the fleet, the east side, west side, outside fishermen, Alaska, and you know, watershed resident fishermen, and then also all different groups of, you know, users in terms of their how united or not they've been on these issues. If it would be great if you could reflect on that from your historical perspective.
Yeah, prior to this mineral prospect here in Bristol Bay being developed, the local residents, the local fishermen here always were against the outside fishermen. We didn't get along. And there's also a battle between the set netters and the drifters, and finally the set netters got an allocation passed, and to this day I don't think the drifters would endorse such a thing. That happened, you know, prior to that we fished all on the same openings and we pulled up our nets on the closures, and so we were all equal then, but then they got their allocation, and that cause a division between the set netters and the drifters. And of course the outside fishermen always seemed to have an advantage because they lived there where the canneries had their headquarters, so they were always involved with being in communication with their set their buyers, whereas if we're lucky, we got a visitor from our fish company once a year, generally around Christmas time. So we always thought that they had an advantage over us, and because of that advantage, we sort of disliked it.
And what also about sports fishermen and sort of environmental groups and environmental interests? Can you tell me about the history of relationships there?
Yeah. In the sports fishing industry, we've seen them obtain a good portion of a resource, and that's a recent activity. You know, in the early 60s is when they started getting into the Bristol Bay for sports fishing organizations, and they became more active in the Board of Fish and Game activities. And nowadays, we don't see any commercial fishery on king salmon, in which we used to fish 5 days a week. Mm. Now we don't have that anymore. Oh, we're lucky if we'll even get one opening during the time that we used to fish for king salmon and sell them to the canneries. But by the reduction of the king salmon resources, it's been all allocated to the... I mean, the sportsmen get a bigger allocation on the king salmon than we do. All we do is we get during the red season we get a small catch of the king salmon.
And what about how the fishing fleet here, did they used to have any interaction with environmental organizations at all in the past? And if so, what was that like, and how does that compare to today?
Well, environmental organizations are something that, you know, just we never knew about Teddy Roosevelt and his activity in environmental push, but we never considered him to be an opponent of ours. Mm. And they were concerned about the preservation of the bears, where we were more concerned about the preservation of the fish. So we've always looked at him with a slanted eye. And they're good people to get along with.
So when, you know, Kim was describing how all these different groups of people were coming together in recent years around the Pebble issue, did that surprise you at all? And from your perspective, too, does it seem like this is something that is can unite people in the way that the unions did in the years in which you were involved in WACMA? Or is it seem like a sort of a different... something different now?
Well, it's a little different because nowadays it's we're resource oriented, and we know what is the mainstay of Bristol Bay is the salmon, and we're concerned about maintaining that importance to, you know, above everything else, because we know our lifetime and our future depend upon a good healthy resource, which our salmon is right now. And we're very concerned about those things which can impact.
I'm curious also if you wanted to speak about how you got your fishing permit. And, you know, another issue that's gotten a lot of attention in this region that you already mentioned is the out-migration of fishing permits. And, you know, whether that was something that the organizations that you were involved with anticipated and were concerned about, and, you know, how you see the future looking there.
Well, the out-migration of permits is something that we didn't visualize at the time of the passage of the limited entry legislation. And my involvement was in the fisheries is that I grew up helping my mom on her set net site and helping my dad on his set net site the time that he fished down at Eacock Beach. And then we moved to Igushik, and I always helped my mom, and then I ended up helping my sister and then my cousin, and then I eventually got into drift fishery with my brother. And then I partnered with Nick Wall in 59 and Billy, in 59. And I partnered with Billy Gertler in 58 and my brother in 57. In 1960, I became a captain of my own boat. And back then, all you needed was a gear license, a vessel license, and a fishing license in order to get, and you had total investment of about $45 for all your licenses. And after limited entry passed, I'm now paying $600 for a limited entry to activate my limited entry permit, and then $60 for my less vessel license or something like that. So the prices have all gone up. But I remember being helping my mom, and I enjoyed fishing. I enjoyed picking fish. But I've been a captain now for 55 years. So.
And so, what were the rest of you doing when William was out fishing? Were you helping on shore the commercial operation? Were you set netting?
We fished in a boat.
Oh, you joined?
Yeah, she fished with me many years.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter fished with me a few years.
And I fished with my mom for a few years.
You want to tell us more about the different fishing operations and how you got involved with those?
Just leave it right here. No, mom, I can remember when I was really young, my mom and dad would leave for the summer, and we would get this babysitter for the entire summer. And life was hell when we had a babysitter that didn't know how to cook. But my mom fished with my dad, and then I think when limited entry came on, then my mom got her permit, and my dad had his permit, so then they had two boats. And by then, my brothers, we were all old enough to go fishing. But I can remember all five of us kids on a boat with my great uncle, because my dad was working. And we would lay in the bunks and read comic books. And that was because you probably had to have, for every kid on board, you got so much gear.
25 fathoms, yeah.
What year was that?
That was the J. Hammond.
Yeah. People always talk about that time.
Yeah.
Do you remember what year
that? It just happened in one year. And then one year I had all my kids on board. Because we, in order to get our allocation of 150 fathoms, we had to have six people on board with gear license.
So we all ended up staying in the bunk and read Archie comic books. Well, they all fished, but I mean, I remember that. But later, my mom and one of my older brothers fished. So Billy fished with you, huh, Mom, mm-hmm. for many years.
And you fished on your own boat with your son. And were there many other women who were out there?
Oh yeah,
all the women seemed like were out there.
There was a lot of fish.
A lot of captains.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Who are some of those captains?
Rosa.
Who, Mom?
Rosa Molkite.
Mm-hmm. Who else?
That was Johnny Bennett's sister.
Blanche Kalstrom, huh?
And a lot of ladies from upriver.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Annie Chocknock.
Yeah. And there's still a few around, like that one lady from...
Julia.
Ishnuk.
Yeah. They all, I mean, as I travel the region now, they'll all ask about my mom and dad, but they talk about mom and fishing. You know, they'll mention, how's your mom doing? And I remember, and that's Annie and Van Chocknock, so Annie, uh-huh. They're all out there. She had her own boat and permit. So
you never, your family, did you set net at all for commercial set net?
Always drift.
Her mom set net in the early years.
Who's
yeah.
my mom?
Yeah. I have pictures of your uncles when they were really young. They must have been like 16 or 15 years old. We set netting down.
By the creek down there.
Yeah, Kanakanak yeah. down there.
Yeah.
Because there's poles. I mean, how they fished from the beach, they had poles up in the nets, and then the picture has all these salmon hanging.
Cool.
Hanging in the web.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just down the beach.
And who bought your fish?
Well, there are a number of canneries around here. Our family, we've fished mainly for Libby McNeil and Libby.
Oh.
So they had a cannery at Eacock. And then Wynne Brindle bought them out in 1959, I think it was, or 58, somewhere around there. But we fished for them, too, until we broke away and started fishing for Pacific American Fisheries, PAF.
PAF.
Also known as Pay After Fishing.
So tell everyone who's listening about that experience. That was that an issue of you had to wait a long time to see your money?
Yeah. Not really. They paid us right after. They mm-hmm. paid before they left. They mm-hmm. paid us before we left.
Mm-hmm.
They left. To go back outside, so our credit was PAF, pay you after fish, pay after fishing. We had credit in the stores, and we had to pay our bills after the fishing season. So it was, reminiscing about the past is good exercise for the brain.
Absolutely.
It pushes away Alzheimer's.
That's true. So maybe, since we just have probably 15 more minutes, is that? Mm-hmm. So maybe we could talk a little bit about like some of the things that you think have stayed the same? We talk so much about the different changes, but are there aspects of living in this region and all the issues we've talked about that stay the same, whether things that are positive or challenges that persist or anything that springs to mind?
Not really, no, but things have really changed to the best, better.
Oh, okay, so tell me more.
Yeah, you know, our travel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can hop in my car and I go to town or go any place or fly to Anchorage anytime. Back then, you know, in the 1940s, it was hard to get from one place to another. You had to make arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we've seen a great change in the way we move around.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, we can, instead of a dog team, we hop on a snow machine when we have, if we get, ever get snow again.
Right.
But so much things have changed. We travel and we got nice highways, good airports that have improved over time. I remember going up river in a boat and the airplanes landing on sandbars. Now all the villages got airports. Back then, it was a different country then.
Mm-hmm.
We had to travel by water or took his chance of flying and going someplace and finding a place to land and then getting picked up and get to the village. But now, things are so much simpler.
Mm-hmm. What about any other thoughts on anything that stayed the same or what's changed the most for the better or for the more complicated?
Another big change that occurred is in our fishing boats.
Mm.
Back then, you know, we had all wood. When I started fishing, we were all wooden boats. Then we gradually moved into fiberglass boats and now mostly aluminum vessels. And the price of the, I remember my first boat I bought was $8,000.
Mm.
And it was a fiberglass boat with a diesel engine.
Wow.
The last boat I bought cost me $185,000. And it has two diesel engines in it. And it was a used boat.
Mm.
So we've seen big changes in our tools of fishing trade.
And it sounds like in terms of thinking about the future of this region and people's livelihoods there, what do you see that looking like? What's the role of fishing in that as you sort of either imagine it or would like to see it?
Well, I'd like to see the price that we get for our salmon improve. Because right now, if it's going to be 50 cents a pound next summer, I don't think I'll watch my vote. Because I can save a lot of money just by keeping it on shore. A lot of people lost money last year. But now I've got a good job with Social Security Administration. So
there are some good changes.
Yeah. That's one thing I like about this country, Social Security.
Any other thoughts from the rest of you about the fisheries and livelihoods in this region and what you see as being important going into the future, what you would like to see?
Well, yeah, I think what struck me sitting here with Dad and Mom is how they were back then as multitaskers. They multitasked and had many changes and many opportunities in the creation of all of these political entities. At the same time, they fought for their fishery and they fought for a price. And so, to me, it's a legacy of what Bristol Bay is made up in the leadership that we have. And I think it's incumbent on my generation and the generation to come after me to be that same way, that we have to multitask. We can't just focus in. And I think so much we focus in on one issue and that issue alone, and we fought this issue related to Pebble, But we need to get back to now being the multitasker and being the leadership and to solve these issues about the out-migration of our permits, the fish price. And if it, that to me, I think, is a takeaway message, is that this generation, you know, we come from a strong legacy, and it's incumbent upon us to do more. Mm-hmm. And not to say, oh, you know, it's, oh, geez, it's changed. Well, damn it. Sure, it's changed, but you better do something about it, because the generation before you did, and they succeeded in giving you what you have today and the opportunity you have today. And so what if you have to only fish in the summer and you get a job in the winter? They did it in the past, and why in the hell can't we do it in the future? That to me is a takeaway.
One of the things I like to mention too is that, you know, back in the early years, fur trapping was a big industry. There was a lot of people here, especially old people in those times, that went up and trapped all winter, came down, and they sold their furs, and they straight up stayed drunk all summer. And then in the fall time, they went back up river again, and that was their life. Mm. But you can't do that anymore. So going back to limited entry, I think one of the resolutions for limited entry is to repeal it. Mm. Once if the state would repeal limited entry and give a date in the future in which it would become effective, that would give people the opportunity to straighten up their affairs and realize that limited entry is going to be done away with. And I think that would get local people more involved into fishery.
Mm, that's interesting. I mean, one last question I had in our last few minutes, given what you both have been talking about just now, is sort of given how involved you all have been in these issues in Bristol Bay, what advice you would have to the leaders who are just coming up? And you already sort of started speaking to that, but if there's any advice, but even also just reflections based on your experience, sort of organizing to fight for issues that were important for the region and still are important for the region, what you think is most important for them to know?
Well, if you're going to make a change in anything, you know, you got to realize that the impact you're going to be having on who's going to be affected by your decisions. And you have to look at everything and find out who's going to be impacted and who's going to be negatively impacted. So you got to figure out a course, a pre-planned course, and then try to convince everybody that they should go this way. That's the way good decisions are made, by getting more people involved. And then hopefully we'll overcome some of these negative impacts that we're having.
Hmm. Oh, no, I would think, and something that I've done is, especially as it relates to like large-scale mining, is making sure that our young people are involved and aware, because, you know, we may not be fighting Pebble much longer because, one, they're in court and they don't have a backing and mineral prices are down. And so, you know, Pebble may go to sleep for a while. And to me, it was important that the young kids get involved and understand the issues because, you know, back in the 80s, sure, I was out of high school, but I had a different course of action, and I left it up to leadership at that time. They were the ones making the decisions. And to me, it's important that our young kids understand the history and be involved and learn that history early on, so that in 20 years, they're going to be much farther ahead of the game than some of us who had to play catch up to understanding why things have happened and why they happened back then versus today. So that's something our kids need to learn, is that it's important to pay attention to the history and to understand the issues, but they'll have another course of action to take. Mm. And the legacy is that the salmon that we harvest every year, whether it's commercially or through subsistence, when I fill up the smokehouse, I want to make sure future generations have that same opportunity. And part of it is they have to participate in that subsistence fishery to understand what it means to pick fish, what it means to split fish or 100 king salmon, you know, what it means to be a family, to do those types of activities, that we have to continue. And that's a good legacy.
Want to add to that at all? Last thoughts?
I don't have anything left.
If you want
clarification on anything, give me a call.
Yeah,
that sounds really good, because there are a lot of details in there, a lot of different organizations, but it's a really important history to reflect on and have documented, and especially given all the work that you did for so many years. So it's really great to be able to have this conversation. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.